Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, originating from soggy San Francisco. As your pronouncer told you, this program is supported by listeners, and I'm very grateful. I want to thank John DeVries, who lives on Vancouver Island. He supports this program, as does Bill Lockemacher from Sacramento. If you'd like to support us, just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. The subscription is voluntary for as little as $5 a month. Today's program is produced and distributed in collaboration with the nonprofit news journalism site, truthout.org. And our solo guest is Professor Henry A. Giroux. He holds the Global TV Network Chair Professorship at McMaster University, that is in Ontario, Canada, and he writes frequently for truthout.org. He has a powerful new book out that we're going to discuss today called Youth in a Suspect Society, subtitled Democracy or Disposability. Henry Giroux, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks, Peter.
Professor, I really appreciate what you have put together in this powerful new book because you've tied in the commodification of people, and in particular youth, the power of corporations, corporate marketing, branding, and the market research that they use to manipulate us and extract more dollars from us. And you tie it to developments in our culture and in our politics that are frightening in many respects. And I think that this is a powerful book that I hope after hearing your conversation today, people will want to read. Tell us first a little bit about your background and how you got to McMaster.
Well, basically my educational route starts in Boston University. I was a professor at Boston University for about 7 years, and at the time the university was taken over by a very right-wing president called John Silber.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Who proceeded to then fire every progressive he could who went up for tenure, and I was one of them. So I ended up going to Miami University. I had a distinguished professorship there. Then I went to Penn State.
That's Miami of Ohio?
Miami of Ohio.
Yeah, I grew up in Cincinnati, so I know Oxford, Ohio.
So you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Penn State, where I had an endowed chair. And then my wife and I got a wonderful job offer in 2004. Just as Bush was being reelected, and we decided it was time to leave the country and to come to Canada, and that's what we did.
And how does that decision feel now? We have a new president, but as we'll discuss, too many critical things have not only not changed; in some ways, they're getting worse.
I don't regret the decision at all. I mean, I think that I often get phone calls from the press saying, you know, now that Obama's president, how would you feel about going back? Because a lot of neoconservatives have thought about going to Israel, you know, and so would you go back to the U.S. as the other side of the coin, I guess. I wouldn't go back because I wouldn't go to any country that doesn't have national health insurance. I mean, I think it's a travesty of justice not to provide one of the most basic elementary necessities for being able to stay out of bankruptcy, maintain your health, and be an engaged and aware citizen. So beyond that, I think the Obama regime has all of a sudden, in some ways, and unfortunately, extended the Bush administration policies in ways that relatively shocking to a lot of progressives. But for me, the issue is not to simply bash Obama. I mean, I think that basically he has a good heart, you know, and I think that in some way he has a vision that is certainly far more progressive than what Bush ever anticipated or could even think about. But I think the burden here is on the left and on progressives to push him in the same way that the right seems to be pushing him. You know, we need to get rid of his economic advisors. We need to get rid of his Secretary of Education. We need for him to take seriously the issue that he repeatedly stated in his various speeches, that youth count, that democracy matters, that markets should not be the ultimate organizing principle for determining everyday life, that incarceration has to be cut back, and that matters of justice and equality should be central to any aspiring democracy.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Henry, and I do believe that Obama has those elements within him. But the continuity of Robert Gates held over as the defense secretary and his influence on this forthcoming decision about more troops in Afghanistan, I find very troubling. The continuity of Paulson to Geithner and the trillions of dollars that have been pushed out to the financial community to rescue them from the huge mess that they created through their greed and their gambling and their cynicism. Those are just a couple of examples. And when it comes to our Fourth Amendment rights, the wiretapping, the eavesdropping, the intercepts of our emails continues unabated. And there's nary an objection coming out of Washington. And they're about to renew the Patriot Act with the most pernicious element, the national security letters, that the FBI itself has admitted have been widely abused. So I hear the message of Obama, but when I measure him by his actions, they come up very short of the promise.
No, believe me, you know, I also write about these things, and I actually have another book coming out on the torture of children. And then there's also the abuse of education, which you know, you didn't mention. But I have no qualms whatsoever about recognizing the absolutely reactionary policies that Obama is instituting. What I find interesting, unlike Bush, is that with Bush there was no contradiction between what he said and what he did. I mean, Bush basically embraced a kind of market-oriented authoritarianism and a sort of religious fundamentalism and a militarism that were quite clear both in his discourse and in his actions. But I think that what is interesting in this administration is that there isn't an enormous contradiction between the ideals and all of the policies that you've laid out. I mean, everything from preventive detention being resurrected to the Patriot Act to taking advice from the very people who, for the most part, supported the financial economic crisis that we find ourselves in, the bailouts that only benefit the rich. These are horrible, horrible policies. But I guess the question here is, you know, what do we do with this? I mean, where do we begin to sort of mine both the contradictions and the possibilities that might ensue? One thing I don't want to do is I don't want to give the government back to the ultra-right. But at the same time, in my best dreams, I'd love to see a third party emerge that in some way can take the country in a very different kind of direction. But I must tell you, I'm not optimistic about that. I'm not optimistic because maybe like you, I really don't see the level of protest that it seems to me we need. I mean, look at FDR. You know, FDR was pushed, and he went in a very different direction. I mean, if you even watch something like the recent film by Michael Moore, this is also on Bill Moyers the other night, where we've actually recovered, you know, FDR naming on television, calling for a second Bill of Rights,
right.
Basically an affirmation of the social state. So, you know, that's the issue for me.
Mm-hmm. Henry A. Giroux's new book, as we mentioned, is called Youth in a Suspect Society. And let's start first with your ideas about the way corporations have turned our kids into a commodity. One of the things that jumps out from reading your book was a stat that a first grader can identify 200 brands, and they are aware of logos at an even earlier age. And these things do have an impact. Any parent who has driven a toddler past a McDonald's and gotten the call for a Happy Meal knows exactly what we're talking about.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I think what's so shocking about this, you know, and this is what I call the soft war on youth. And the soft war is that basically being waged against all youth. And that war is the war of commodification, I mean, in which students and young people and toddlers and kids and tweens are constantly being given the option, are constantly being situated in positions where they're being educated to believe that the only, that you define democracy by buying goods, that the only thing that really matters is a world of commodities, that the only life that's worth fighting for is whether you can, you know, ultimately find yourself in a mall and get a discount. But what is really shocking about this, because this has been going on for a long time, but what is really shocking now is that there is a technology and a new media out there that corporations are exploiting that bypass parents. I mean, you know, kids are like, a, you know, represent a $200 billion market. And it seems to me that what we increasingly see are these advertising companies sort of taking very seriously all the ways in which they can exploit existing modes of education to simply not only commodify students, but basically to turn them into walking advertisements for the corporation.
Well, and the messages that are received are fascinating. And as you point out in the book, Henry, on the one hand, we are seduced by advertising messages and the whole implicit idea that in order to be cool and to be sexy and to get that beautiful woman, you've got to do what the corporate messages tell you to do. And on the other hand, we're just a number. We're just consumers. And once the dollars have been extracted from our debit cards and our wallets, we're then disposable. We're just another, you know, unit that is easily replaced by some other consumer.
This is really one of the most shocking elements of what we might call this hyper-capitalism or market fundamentalism, or as some people call it, neoliberalism. I mean, what you know, in years past, there were safety nets, you know, for people. In years past, you know, people cared about the spaces that students and young people occupy. They were seen as a social investment. Today, they're simply seen as an investment for short-term profits. I mean, I think that what we often see now is that those kids who, in fact, are failed consumers are just simply, like anything else, they become disposable. They're excess. They're not worthy. They no longer are seen as human beings that, in some fundamental way, deserve a sense of adult responsibility and, in some way, a part of a social contract. Now, all you have to do is, for instance, walk into any school which is filled with ads in textbooks, you know, ads on the buses, ads in the bathroom. I mean, corporations sort of driving what kids learn.
Channel One is in how many classrooms in the United States?
Thousands. I mean, thousands of schools. I mean, and what does it do? I mean, it basically tells students that the only obligation of citizenship is basically consuming, to be a consumer. I mean, what we are doing here is positioning our children not just simply to be illiterate politically, socially, and economically, and to disengage them from any viable understanding of what it means to be critical and engage and organize and govern the world in which we live. But we so place them at such a disadvantage in terms of being able to confront, read through, critically engage, and resist this utterly commodified world that, in the end, I'm not sure what it means for a democracy when students really can't think beyond simply questions of goods and products. The utter disingenuousness of this on a corporate level is staggering.
And Henry, I want to come back to Channel One for just a second here and contrast the way that that is accepted by parents, by educators, by marketers and corporations. Yet when Barack Obama scheduled a speech on the first, you know, during roughly the first week of school, right after Labor Day, this past September, there was this outcry from the right that you know, making it possible or even in some cases mandatory for students to see an address from the President of the United States was somehow an inappropriate propaganda move when, as you just pointed out, these same students are surrounded by all kinds of corporate propaganda all the time.
Endlessly. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, engaging in some way supporting the dictates of capital, that becomes patriotic. Whereas, you know, to listen to a president of the United States urge students in some way to get ahead and take their education seriously, not just simply as consumers, to say the least, but as engaged citizens who need to learn about the world in order to be able to learn how to be governed, learn how to govern and not just be governed, is called socialistic. We know what that means. I mean, I think what that really indicates is less a kind of ignorance about Obama and what he has to say about education than it does a very savvy understanding of the struggle that is taking place on the part of the right over education itself. They know how important education is. For them, education is the ultimate site where they can produce particular kinds of subjects, desires, identities, particular notions of what it means to be in the world, particular projections of the future. So they take it seriously. I mean, the left really doesn't take education seriously. It doesn't take schooling seriously, and it doesn't take it doesn't take education in the wider society seriously. So it seems to me that we shouldn't be affronted as much as we should raise the question, what's the politics at work here? I mean, what exactly is this about beyond a display of what appears to be on the surface a kind of stupid right-wing sort of ideological reaction to something that simply exposes who they are? Mm-hmm. So for me, I think there's something more systemic at work in that attack.
And Henry, I'd like to sketch a little bit for you and get your reaction to the scene here in California, because we have this washed-up action movie star playing governor. He is beholden to the Republican, air quotes, principles of low tax and less government. And in fact, Grover Norquist, the low tax activist from Washington, is really running things in California, because he extracted pledges from all the Republican legislators not to raise taxes. And when a couple of them defected from that, he promptly started recall campaigns to take them out. It's a very effective political discipline system. And it's Grover Norquist who is imposing disaster capitalism on California. So Schwarzenegger takes office, and pandering to the public, he rolls back the tax on automobiles. And if he had not done that, there's $26 billion that would have flowed into the state treasury over the last 6 years, and our budget deficit would have been much more manageable, in the range of about $15 billion instead of the 40-plus that we've been working with over the last 18 months. So with that in mind, Schwarzenegger jammed through an all-cuts budget this past summer so that we now spend more on corrections than we do on higher education. And the vaunted California university system, the state universities, the community colleges have all had massive cutbacks and huge increases in tuition and fees. These are tax increases, but they're not called that in the Republican playbook. And so we have this contrast that over the next 10 years, there will be a massive disinvestment in the future generations, the youth of the state of California, in terms of education and productivity. Yet we will continue to invest massively in a failed system of criminal justice, incarceration, fueled by wars on drugs and those sorts of things. And I really fear for the net result. In 10 years, I think that we're going to have a California that barely resembles the state that I moved to 32 years ago.
You know, you're absolutely right. I think that this has been in place for a while, hasn't it? I mean, these kinds of policies, I mean, we've seen them, we saw them emerge with, of course, Reagan, another Californian, you know, who in his railing against big government is the problem. And I think that, just as you're suggesting, this call to, in some way, cut back on taxes, both for the rich and otherwise, I mean, we know what that means. I mean, this is really a disinvestment in the social state. This is really a disinvestment in the public sphere, and it's a disinvestment in the future of young people. The argument here is simple. Lower the taxes, government collapses, then we can privatize everything. And I think that's exactly what this is about. I mean, I think that people like Grover Norquist, who really symbolizes kind of radical market evil, has no conception of the common good, except as a pathology, has no conception of the public sphere, except as a pathology, and basically will do everything he can, along with his Republican counterparts, to undermine any possibility for the social state to in some way ensure the provide the investments in schools and hospitals and healthcare and or anything else that would expand and both deepen democracy and expand the possibility of the public good.
And so as you take a look at this, let me lift a quote from your book here that I think helps put this in context. You say, "I argue that under the biopolitics of neoliberalism, American society has undergone a sea change in the daily lives of children that marks a major transition from a culture of innocence and social protection, however imperfect, to a culture of commodification. This is culture that does more than undermine the ideals of a secure and happy childhood. It also exhibits the bad faith of a society in which, for children, there can only be one kind of value, market value, one kind of success, profit, one kind of existence, commodities, and one kind of social relationships, markets. Children now inhabit a cultural landscape in which they can only recognize themselves in terms preferred by the market."
This is horrible. I mean, it basically is a kind of death sentence politically for young kids. I mean, it not only depoliticizes them and not only disengages them and removes them from a sphere of politics in which that this generation really represents, as we all know, the most basic kind of hope for the future. But it does something dreadful. I mean, it turns them into socially and morally irresponsible consumers, meaning that as consumers, they have no sense of the value of public life. They have no language to talk about democracy. They have no language to talk about community. I mean, I often find myself with students who, when we talk about solidarity, community, the social state, the public good, the common good, they have no idea what that means. I mean, you know, when you raise a generation to live in a world that is utterly privatized, try to understand what that deficit means politically in terms of being able to recognize the obligations one has to the other, the obligations that one has to the issue of social responsibility, what it means to nurture a sense of civic courage, what it means to tell, educate students to be critical in ways that allow themselves to be more than simply workers or consumers. I mean, that's, you know, and I know, look, democracy demands a formative culture. Democracy demands an educated citizenry. You take that formative culture away, you take that model of civic education away, and you're on the road to authoritarianism. That's how it works. It works because people become ignorant. You, Peter, you mentioned something earlier that it seems to me falls right into this in a very obvious way. I mean, when we talk about the way in which the social state is being disinvested and destroyed by virtue of this policy of reducing taxes, for instance, what happens here? What happens is that we pit tax recipients in need of safety nets basically against taxpayers. I mean, you know, what kind of a friend-enemy contradiction is that? I mean, the very people who, in fact, need these services, and these services are going to come from where? They're going to come from, it seems to me, in some way, a tax base that offers the, from tax receipts from corporations and from the rich and from others who can afford to pay this, who are going to expand in some way the public good and maximize in some way what it means for all of us to be able to live in a society without injustices.
And Henry, as I'm looking at some of the themes in your book, and let me try to pull a couple of them together. On the one hand, corporate messages, advertising, and the like, imbue young people with a sense of desire and a sense of entitlement of the good things in life, fast cars and fancy houses and bling and, you know, whatever we see as the important icons of materialism. And at the same time, we are, our generation is going to saddle them with so much debt and economic wreckage that these are, you know, these are destined to crash, to crash against one another in a way that will produce social pathologies.
And, I mean, there are a couple of things at work here, and one of them is a hangover from the last point. I mean, first of all, different groups will be affected differently, as we well know. And we also know that whenever we talk about disinvesting in public services and schools and jobs, these messages are always racially coded. We know that. I mean, we know what that means. I mean, the attack on welfare, the welfare state, we know it's an attack on blacks, poor blacks, minorities, Latinos. We know all that. But I think the other side of the question that you're raising is that as these pathologies get produced, as all of a sudden we find a generation in debt without jobs, without social services, the question will then become, how will they be controlled? I mean, what role will the state play in producing this collective pathology? And I think what we see in happening in California with the passing of that, the rejection of that bill recently that would have reformed the prison system, is indicative of what's going to happen. And that is that as the social state collapses, the punishing state gets stronger because it's one of the few things the state is really capable of now controlling. And that model of punishment begins to seep through every aspect of the social order so that increasingly what were once social problems for young people now become criminalized behaviors, zero tolerance policies in schools. It goes on and on. But it seems to me that you're going to have two things. You'll have a generation that basically will not be able to invest in the most obvious ways in order to maintain a style of life that matters with all the benefits that matter. And secondly, in order to deal with that, you won't have a social investment on the part of the state. What, in fact, you'll have is the rise of a punishing state with increasingly disturbing disciplinary procedures put in place that will be the only effective way to be able to be effective.
Henry, one of the elements that you tie into this picture that really echoed some thoughts that I've had over a period of time is not just the level of marketing and corporate propaganda that is imposed on the average young American, but the degree to which market research has enabled them to really fine-tune the messages they send and the degree of manipulation that they are capable of exercising. And to me, the best symptom of this is the proliferation of so-called reality television programs in the United States. Now, I know the industry well enough to tell you that these crappy shows cost them a lot less to produce than a primetime hour of a drama or even a sitcom. And that they also, again, this is my theory, used market research to discover ways to put on programs that viewers find compelling, but that don't have any substance, don't have any depth, don't have any art to them. And they simply, put into a blender or a food processor the various results of market research that cause people to sit in front of the tube and watch stuff and respond to the commercials and the product placements embedded in those programs.
No, I think that, the dominant media has simply become an advertisement for, a world in which the only thing that really matters are market values and market goods. But I also think, Peter, there's something else at work in reality TV, which you're hinting at, which I think is really quite crucial. And that is that when we try to understand what corporations are about, they're not just economic entities. I mean, they're also educational entities. And power always needs to legitimate itself in order to reproduce itself. And I think that one of the things that reality TV has now come to serve is that it's like a giant classroom for economic Darwinism. I mean, it endlessly gives us the same message over and over again. And that is that, life is a war of all against all. Somebody wins, everybody else loses. The best people sort of get to the top. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's sort of a giant broadcasting educational tool for what I have called elsewhere market neoliberalism as a theater of cruelty. I mean, reality TV is really a celluloid screen culture induced theater of cruelty, and it produces what Adorno once called an ideology of hardness in the culture. A kind of indifference to community, the social responsibility, to all those kinds of values that matter if people are going to be able to work together to solve collective problems. I mean, it's insidious. It sort of makes Goebbels look like a Boy Scout in terms of the enormous, not only power that I think it has ideologically and educationally as a force in the culture, but also its ubiquitousness. I mean, it is like, as you've said, it's not just because it's cheap, it also because it resonates with the people who sponsor this stuff. They love this stuff. I mean, this is an ideology for neoliberalism, front and center. It's an ideology that basically is about the culture, that both produces, reproduces, and legitimates a theater of cruelty and a culture of cruelty.
The other thing that I sense in this arena is that they have figured out ways to make the couch potato feel like a king. And the power that you have in your remote control, it is, it resembles a weapon in many respects, is used. And they have figured out ways to, you know, to keep you from straying too far. And so they feed your ego that you're a better dancer than Tom DeLay, that, you know, you're superior to the fifth grader who got it right and the adult who didn't. You know, all this is based on feeding the ego, pandering to the vanity and the narcissism of the viewer, but only for short-term gain. It's not like educational television where we're trying to help people grow and expand and become better human beings. It's a very cynical, short-term puffery and pandering that is used simply to extract your loyalty to a brand, your money from your wallet.
I mean, I think there are a couple of things that go on here, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it completely panders to a kind of excessive narcissism, but it also does so within a set of circumstances that I think that need to be explained. I mean, remember, you know, the public, as public spheres become entirely privatized, the only place that people now can connect with other people are in these disembodied sort of spectacles that are both constantly on display vis-a-vis their television, the internet, or who knows what other technologies are being used. I mean, these are utterly privatized cultures. I mean, I mean, people in some ways are trapped because there are no social systems in place anymore to allow people to get outside of that kind of one-dimensional sort of viewing. But I think that what I find so shocking about this is that it's not only that it panders to a kind of narcissistic, as you say, egotistic kind of sense of the self. There are two things at work that are really shocking. One is it constantly ups the ante through the spectacle of the shock.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that endlessly by disparaging others.
Yep.
So at one level, you have the spectacle of shock and awe, which is ongoing, until it gets to the point where we'll be imitating those movies where prisoners will all of a sudden, you know, find themselves in gladiator-like arenas, and you know, whoever's ever the last one standing will, you know, be set free, and people will bet on this. I mean, it's a kind of casino capitalism,
mm-hmm.
you know, in which there's a certain pleasure that is derived in other people's pain, and I think that's the fascistic element in this. I mean, it's really the aesthetics of fascism. I mean, it's not just a pandering to the self. I mean, there is a culture of cruelty at work here that tells us something about how adults can be so turned off to children and to be so turned off to young people and investing in their future. Young people represent the return of the repressed, right? I mean, young people are a constant reminder that adults have social obligations, that there's a social contract, that you simply can't live on that couch alone, sort of reveling in the disparagement of and denigration of other people's lives. That's why they're so dangerous.
Mm-hmm. One other element that I think creeps in here is judgment. And I'm not talking about good judgment versus bad judgment. I'm talking about human beings judging other human beings. And to me, the low point of this is Nancy Grace, who has this Crime of the Day show. And by the end of her half hour, she has tried and convicted a suspect who hasn't even been before a judge. And I think that this creeps into people's thinking where they feel empowered to make very critical and deep judgments about the behavior of others based simply on what they've seen on television. And you and I are speaking less than 24 hours after the psychiatrist soldier shot and killed a dozen at Fort Hood in Texas. And already there are many people who formed very clear and deep judgments about the alleged shooter, about the situation, about various factors that they believe have contributed to it. And this is based on massive ignorance and very little fact. And many people are quite comfortable with that.
Well, I think that speaks to a number of issues. I mean, I think that, this kind of ultra-moralism there's a kind of political purity now at work in the culture that really disengages, a kind of hypocrisy that really makes any kind of notion of thoughtfulness and judgment just really dysfunctional. But I think it also lends itself to something else. I mean, I think the culture of cruelty is partly buttressed by what I call the new illiteracy. And this new illiteracy is a mode of engaging the world in which there is no distinction between opinion and evidence. There's no distinction made anymore between opinion and judgments and thoughtful judgments. I mean, people now lie, and they lie operating under the assumption that in some way it doesn't matter, that who cares, right? I mean, we lie. That's just part of what the political process is about. In other words, there has been such a moral and intellectual collapse under the weight of various fundamentalisms that now operate in circles of certainty that it becomes difficult to recognize when judgment and thoughtfulness and dialogue are actually being exercised. I mean, who knows better than you do? I mean, but the Glenn Becks, the Hannitys of the world, I mean, these are people who simply shout into microphones. They make stuff up. They literally make stuff up. Then you look at the news, the dominant media, that then treats them as serious analysts, and you begin to understand what's happening here. What you begin to understand that in a country that is forfeiting on its obligations to democracy, literacy becomes a liability.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a liability if you're a professor in a university. It becomes a liability if you're in public broadcasting or on the radio like yourself. It becomes a liability if you're a journalist. And in the best of all worlds, if you don't want to occupy that space of political literacy, then you just say, I'm for balance. I don't really believe in anything. I just believe that all positions should be treated equally, and we can throw the issues of judgment and discrimination and thoughtfulness and dialogue right out the window. And that's what we see today. And that may be the most distressing and disparaging element in the political culture, the inability to any longer translate private issues into public considerations, to understand that the lives that people lead in these individual cocoons in which they've been wrapped by corporations and others basically prevents them from understanding the larger systemic forces that bear down on their lives, and they have no language to address that. So where do they go? They say it's about character. You know, poverty is about character. Homelessness means you're too lazy to live in a house. Unemployment, if you're unemployed, it means that you can't, you want to sit back and watch TV all day. There are so many elements to this issue that are so disturbing that when you put them all together, it's hard to believe that under the current circumstances, this democracy, in as weak as it is, has any chance of survival without, in a sense, taking seriously the need to produce an educated citizenry.
And I think that this explains, to some extent, the success that a man of limited communication skills like George W. Bush had with the American public. He presented a series of false choices on a regular basis. He offered a contempt for intellectualism, for science, for any kind of deep thinking. And it really resonated, or as he malapropped, resonated, with a lot of Americans who didn't want to be bothered with complex thinking, who want to believe that if Jack Bauer tortures somebody and they cough up information, well, then we can torture people because it'll make us safer. And it really bends my mind to see how many people who nominally are intelligent, they have degrees, they function as professionals, and yet they embrace the very shallow thinking, often based on obvious ignorance, that really is pervasive in our culture today.
No, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, I think that, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, boy, it's really odd, isn't it, that as the country is all of a sudden in the worst economic recession it's ever been in, as, you know, thousands, 13 million kids live in poverty, I mean, 9.4 million without health insurance, it goes on and on, millions dying because they don't get adequate health care. What we get in response to that is really a privatized world of fantasy, spectacle, and resentment, in which, in some ways, you can say that either people are so overwhelmed by information that they're not able to judge it properly, or you can say that those public spaces and public institutions that matter around when it comes to addressing the hard work of educating people to understand and confront these issues have now been so undermined, so disinvested, so destroyed, that all we have left are these highly commodified, utterly commercialized public spheres that simply revel, as you said, in entertainment as shock, in spectacle as a form of entertainment. But I also do think that, you know, you mentioned something that I think is worth addressing, and I think at some level there is a real refusal to take seriously what we might call social contract. I mean, what does it mean to address in some fundamental way the fact that the problems that we now face are so collectively interrelated that we can no longer simply isolate ourselves and remove ourselves to either the mall or the couch in addressing these? And what is it about intellectuals who absolutely in some way understand the nature of these social problems, but endlessly around the take and being paid to do everything they can to undermine the possibility of addressing those issues? I mean, what forces are at work in this country that so compromise, commodify, and appropriate intellectuals that either they hide behind a firewall of jargon that's impenetrable in some cases in the universities, or they hide behind a firewall of profit in which they're simply being paid off to provide misinformation? I mean, where are the forces at work that in some way say, hey, look, you know, let's recognize what these problems are and suggest that in some way there has to be an attempt to address publicly and socially and educationally what it means to offer a different kind of subjectivity, a different notion of what it means to be alive in the world, a different notion of what it means to have a conscience.
Henry Giroux, let me turn to the portion of your book that talks about the punishing state. And I'd like to read another quote. While the rise of neoliberalism has undermined the most basic values and institutions of democracy in the U.S., it has had a particularly devastating effect on youth, as the combined modalities of regulation, control, surveillance, and punishment radically alter the public spheres inhabited by minority youth. While all youth are now suspect, poor minority youth have become especially targeted by modes of social regulation, crime control, and disposability that have become the major prisms that now define many of the public institutions and spheres that govern their lives. And this term disposability is something that I have cringed at when I've heard it coming from elected leaders, members of both parties, who have told me that when they look at gang violence in Los Angeles, when they look at even, you know, suburban white young criminals who are involved in methamphetamines or other drug problems, that they're prepared to write them off, to write off a whole generation, and just to say, I give up. And the cheapest way to deal with these losers is just to lock them up and forget about them. And they imagine that somehow you can simply warehouse problems and that they won't come out of the warehouse at some point and be more toxic than they were when they went in. And so I'd like you to particularly address this issue of disposability, because I think it's a really pernicious concept, and I think that there are many people who have bought into it.
I mean, the notion of disposability begins with the absolute breakdown of the social contract. I mean, the social contract said that the state had an obligation in some way to reinvest in people, to offer rehabilitation, for instance, instead of and not simply prison and not simply punishment. It said that there were institutions that provided this. There were there were social welfare institutions. There were job programs. There was a notion that quality education mattered for young people. But I think from the 1980s on, we've moved into a very different set of ideological assumptions. And what the social contract did, what that now means is that social investment is out and punishment is in. And hence, a whole range of institutions have emerged that have taken over that can now constitute what I would call the punishment industry, in which the basic assumption is that crime is the governing axis to which we will now address the modalities that once were only addressed by virtue of pointing to the prison. We have expanded the model of the prison now to cover, particularly with young people and particularly with poor minority young people, a whole range of issues. This really is really quite obvious around three things. I mean, first of all, we look at young people in schools, particularly minorities of class and color, who are now subjected to zero tolerance policies that are so disproportionately punitive in terms of the populations they affect that it's actually mind-blowing. I mean, the people who are being arrested in schools, the people who are being handcuffed, the people who are being sent to juvenile courts are primarily minorities. I mean, can you imagine? We have kids now. Safety issues in schools now are not handled by guidance teachers. They're handled by police departments. We have kids now who violate a dress code and basically are pulled out of the school, put in handcuffs, and taken to a jail, photographed, and basically then have to appear in juvenile court. This is unheard of. So we have, second, we have this crime complex in which all of a sudden we have guards, this disciplinary apparatus emerging, in which guards replace teachers. Security officers replace teachers. The police are strolling around the schools with guns in their holsters. There was a, I don't know if you know about this case, about, I think, a month ago, or in May, I'm sorry, May of this year, where a special needs kid was walking down a corridor in a special needs school. Can you imagine? And a police officer tells him to tuck in his shirt. And he's about to tuck it in, but apparently he didn't do it fast enough. This is all caught on video. So the cop then goes over, beats him, pummels him, pushes him to the ground, breaks his nose, and we later learned that cop had been in another police force in Florida and had actually shot the husband of his ex-wife 24 times. Can you believe this? After the case, he was arrested for raping somebody. I mean, these are the people we're putting in schools to deal with kids. And I think the third issue is that there's been a breakdown in schools between schools and between education and juvenile delinquency. We now treat almost all behaviors or infractions as basically something that should be referred to the juvenile, to the criminal justice system. So we have this model of the prison being exported to schools. We have it being exported to the streets. We have truancy laws in California and other states where kids, even if they have legitimate excuses, are being fined $250, escalating to $500. And then if their parents don't pay the $500, if they live in public housing, they're being evicted. Then we have kids who go from schools through the juvenile delinquent system right into prisons. This is unheard of. I mean, this has to be one of the most shameful episodes we have ever seen in American society.
Well, and Henry, you referenced Michael Moore's Capitalism, a Love Story, and I give him credit for including in a portion of that film a description of this insidious situation in Pennsylvania where corrupt judges in presiding over juveniles would sentence them to a privatized juvenile facility from which they got kickbacks to the tune of millions of dollars. So here they are profiting personally by corrupting the law and taking individual young people and abusing their civil rights, their criminal justice rights, in a way that I used to think unimaginable.
I mean, Peter, it's interesting because it's the perfect marriage of a kind of ruthless market sensibility and the hatred of young people. It's perfect. I mean, it doesn't just speak to the breakdown of the juvenile justice system. I mean, it speaks to a set of values that has so engulfed and shaped that system that even when in the we hear of the most extreme case, as in this case, and what I find interesting about that case is that almost nobody wrote about the kids. I mean, they were just simply appalled by the ethical infraction of the judges. But I heard very few stories about these thousands of kids who had been locked up for months, whose lives were ruined, because they're disposable. I mean, these kids are considered disposable. These kids are either flawed consumers, or they're considered not just simply at risk, but the risk. They're considered a threat and a problem to society. I mean, imagine, each year in the United States, the police make 2.2 million juvenile arrests. 2.2 million, with 1.7 million being referred to the juvenile courts. I mean, we're incarcerating a whole generation of kids who, as you said earlier, will come out, will not be able to vote, will not be able to live in public housing, will not be able to get academic scholarships, particularly if it's a drug violation. And so what you do is you dismantle the possibility for an entire generation of young blacks and Latinos from ever being productive in that society. And in the long run, society pays for that. I mean, you know, in Rhode Island, it costs $45,000 a year, $45,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. I mean, what does it cost to go to Harvard?
About $45,000.
$45,000.
Somewhere in there.
We could send every kid in the country to Harvard if we dismantled the system for nonviolent offenders. I mean, it tells you something about the kinds of priorities and the other disdain. But I do want to go back to this question of disposability. And I think that when young people are no longer seen as a social investment, when we can no longer think in terms of long-term goals about the future, but only short-term goals to ratchet up market profits, then I think kids become the enemy. They become a drag on the economy. They become a drag on, particularly poor kids, they become a drag on adult responsibility. They reveal the way in which the social contract now has been repressed. And hence, what do? We punish them. And hence, we have the rise of a system in the United States in which the prison becomes the ultimate model and incarceration becomes the ultimate endpoint for generations of young, poor, and black kids.
So, Henry, what do you propose we do going forward to try to change this, to try to limit the impact, to try to reduce the commodification, and to push back on the model of the punishing state?
I think there are a number of things that we need to do. I mean, I think that first of all, and I let me go from the abstract to the particular, I'll be very quick. I mean, I think that first of all, we need to reclaim the relationship we need to reclaim what it means to live in a democracy and the formative culture and institutions that make it possible. You can't live in a democracy with massive inequality. You can't live in a democracy with five or six corporations running almost every aspect of the country in different spheres, from drugs to the media. You can't live in a country without a decent education system. So that means you have to talk about priorities. I mean, where do you want to put your money? Do you want to put your money in a war economy, the wars in Afghanistan, the wars in Iraq, in a military budget that's completely out of control? Or do you want to take seriously FDR's Second Bill of Rights and invest in housing and invest in, in jobs for young people and invest in education? I mean, we've got to make that decision, but those kinds of priorities have to be struggled and fought for, and they have to be struggled and fought for in every site where people are being educated, from the schools to the media. So we need social movements that are not just about demonstrations, but about mobilizing for the long term. And in doing so, take very, very, very seriously what it means to make education central to their politics. Honestly, if we can't raise consciousness, if we can't educate people who are being oppressed to the forces that are oppressing them, if we can't make visible how power works through this mammoth military-industrial-academic complex, we're gone. It's over. You can't foster reform on people. You have to mobilize people to believe that they're fighting for something that really is going to benefit them and others. And that's the struggle that we face.
Henry A. Giroux, spelled G-I-R-O-U-X. The new book is Youth in a Suspect Society, subtitled Democracy or Disposability. I've really enjoyed our conversation, Henry, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Send me your feedback by email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until